Thank you so much for coming. Again, welcome to Context. I'm Susan Stevens, and really appreciate you being here for Safe Neighborhoods, Safe City, The Changing Roles of Police and Community. Our guests tonight are Rockford Police Chief Chet Epperson. Also, we have, well, I should probably have started at this end, Rockford Mayor Larry Morrissey, State Representative Letisa Wallace, Chet Epperson, and we also have Community Impact Manager for United Way and co-leader of My Brother's Keeper, Matthew Simpson. Thank you so much for giving us your time tonight. We really appreciate it. By the way, if you are a Periscope user, which is something you can do through Twitter, you can get to this. We're doing a live feed of this through Periscope. Go to at WNIJ News, and you can get there through there. But you have to install the Periscope app, which I'm told is free. I don't know why we saw that $1.99 version of it when we were looking. These context events are about community discussions and ways to bring people together to talk about and experience some different aspects of our community. This is our first one in Rockford. I'm pretty excited about that. So we're very pleased that you're here. And by the way, if you have any ideas for future context topics, talk to Maria. Maria, where are you? Upstairs. So don't go upstairs. She'll be back down here. But Maria Boynton is here, and or grab any one of us from the station. You'll notice we're probably wearing name tags and or shirts that say WNIJ, WNIU. I'd like to thank Kate's Pie Shop for the pie bites. If you didn't get them, make sure you grab one in the back. We also have water if you'd like some of that this evening. Now, I'm going to ask, as our format, I'm going to ask a few preliminary questions to get things going. And then we are going to take some questions from the audience. And like Victor said earlier, you can write your question on a card. And we have a couple people who will come pick up the card from you. I'm going to move my phone. It's making too much noise. So once you've got one written down and you'd like to get it, they're out there. But they'll be watching. It's Janet and Kathy, and so if you have a question done, you can just wave it, and they'll come get it, and then we'll get to those questions. Also, we are going about asking questions, answering questions through you asking them. So we've got microphones, and I'm just so you know, since we are recording this, and we want to have it sound good. So our people who have the microphones are going to be Jenna. Nope. Victor, and also Guy Stevens, and they will bring the microphones to you. If the cord won't reach far enough, we'll ask you to come a little toward them, and they will keep hold of the microphone. For one thing, we want to keep as good of sound as possible, because I know when someone hands me a microphone, I'm likely to start waving it around, and the sound is terrible. So we're going to keep those questions we'll get to pretty soon. And we want to make sure everyone has enough time. And the thing is, we do want questions. We want you to be able to ask questions of these great panelists that we have here. If you have statements you would like to make, we'll ask them to stick around a little bit afterward, or you can talk to one of us here at WNIJ as well afterward. All right. Again, cards everywhere. Write it out, hand it off, and let's get things underway. I'd like to start with just, I'm assuming that you know these people. These are people who are part of your community, very important. So we're not going to do the usual intro and statements and that sort of thing. So we're going to get right into the questions. And I'd like to start with Mayor Morrissey, and then whoever else would like to answer it down the line. One more thing is we aren't timing the questions. I kind of enjoy that at League of Women Voters events, being the timekeeper who gets to hold up the signs. 30 seconds. Yeah, the cutoff person. But since this isn't a debate, we're going to let people tell us. But I will, maybe I'll start looking at my fake watch or something if you're really going on. But I'd like to start with, what's being done to build and strengthen trust between the police and the public?
So this is a question that I could go on literally for a long period of time, and I'll try to be as succinct as I can and pass it on to the other panelists to join in. And really, this is the theme that I expect. There's probably multiple questions and angles that we could take on it. let me just try to say this as succinctly as I can. There's probably been no issue as tough, probably everything that I've had to deal with that is tough as mayor comes in a somewhat distant second to the challenges that we've had in police community relations, combined with police administration, union, overall personnel issues. It's been the singular defining probably element of my administration over the last 10 years. And I will say that while the challenge was is most probably known about what happened in August of 2009 when Mark Anthony Barmore was shot and killed, really the path and the challenges began very early on in my administration as the chief came into office. When we had the 276-6 campaign, the no confidence vote against the chief, when we were moving forward on a number of initiatives to modernize the police department, and to recognizing that we had there were gaps and there were lapses that were starting to be recognized across the country that we were trying to improve upon. So we were already on a process of making changes when Mark Anthony Barmore was shot and killed. What that did was really move us and accelerate the pace of changes within the organization. I can tell you where we are today is looking at the Barmore shooting, looking at all the other initiatives we've been involved with through a different lens. And that lens is what's happened over the last 18 months or so since Ferguson and various other shootings across the country have really brought to bear a national spotlight on challenges that we were locally dealing with in August of 2009 and before and still today. So I think what we can look back and say is that we have been doing and been on a path to build credibility, not just based on my words, not based on the chief's words, but based on systems that are verifiable, that have been validated by outside agencies and including national accreditation organizations. And I think most recently have been validated by the fact that many of the systems that we put in place that were controversial have now been mandated by state law. Representative Walz can certainly talk in more detail about that. But the governor just signed into law the Police Community Relations Improvement Act. It's something that I fully support. Happy to talk about that in more detail. But that also followed earlier this year, the Task Force on 21st Century Policing really laid out a lot of the strategies and best practices, many of which have become now part of that state law. I want to congratulate Representative Wallace as one of the sponsors in the state of Illinois for being a national leader and trying to embody many of these best practices into a comprehensive law. There's a lot of things that have not gotten done this year in Springfield, probably, budget being one of them. But that's one that I think we can be proud of as a state, moving us forward. And again, we always want to have trust. We always want to build relations. But I think we have the ability to now build relationships on verifiable data and systems that are help us to be as successful as we can be.
And State Representative Wallace, obviously, he kind of set you up for your section on this. What is the state? What can a state representative do?
I think it's incumbent upon representatives to support policies that are like this Policing and Community Relations Act that was just signed. As the mayor mentioned, we are the first state in the nation to put into and codify in one spot all of the recommendations that ultimately came out of President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force. So there was a report released in May. We had already been working through many of the issues that ended up in the president's report. And over the years, as a community, just being involved in the community, there were so many things that I noticed before coming into office. And so I proposed a bill very early on to look at some of those things. And one of them was how we train police officers. And I proposed a bill that would include implicit racial bias training. And this is something that Epperson and I have talked about over the years after having met after the Barmore shooting. And basically what that is a subconscious bias, a subconscious fear or response to being presented with a black or brown suspect or black or brown individual in a setting that might be a criminal setting. And I worked really hard to try to craft something that would ultimately start to address that. And that particular bill became incorporated into what is now the Policing and Community Relations Improvement Act, along with several other major several other major points of training for police officers as they go into their profession. It also creates the ability for greater accountability, which I think helps to build trust. But I believe as a state representative, the goal is to support policies that allow for our community to be able to come together. And I think that this is just one example of doing that.
Okay, thanks. And Chief Epperson.
Well, first, it's exciting to be here to talk about some great things in the police department and what we're doing with the community. And look back at the echo what the mayor has to say. So we're from I came in as 2006 as a chief, and several things occurred from six up until three significant policies that are out the 21st century policing from President Obama and his task force. The state of Illinois, the representative talks about with the police reforms, and then BLM, Black Lives Matter, police reform. If we take all three of those documents and they're sort of weave them in, the Rockford Police Department and the city of Rockford, the residents should be very proud and honored. The fact is that we've been on this sort of path of self-reform. And if you look across the country, really police departments get reformed either two ways. You do it internally, and you have the strife that we've seen internally, or if you can't make the internal changes, then somebody on the outside will come in and tell you what to do. That's i.e. a consent decree. So police chiefs across the country that can't manage their departments, i.e. Seattle, New Orleans, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Detroit, Oakland, the list goes on and on. Ferguson, Missouri will be another one, Cleveland, Ohio, Newark, New Jersey. Those departments were not able to self-sustain any internal changes. They lack the sustainability and the capacity to move departments forward. So the federal government comes in and then has a consent decree that costs millions of dollars. So two ways to reform the department. You do it internally. You see the sort of things that take place the last few years. Or you give up and you have federal monitors and consent decrees, and it costs taxpayers quite a bit of money because the leadership inside of a police department can't make those fundamental changes. So proud of the work that our department, our officers have done. We're in a very good position. Are we perfect? No. Are we making changes to improve community relations with the residents in the city of Rockford? Absolutely. And we'll go on and some more questions I know that you've had. I've seen the list. And so, again, excited to be here with the panel.
Thank you. Matthew Simpson, now as your work with United Way and My Brother's Keeper, what sort of things are you seeing that are being done to build, mm-hmm. strengthen that trust between police and the public?
Well, a lot of what we do, especially with United Way, as well as the work that's being done through My Brother's Keeper, is we do a lot of listening, trying to listen to people and get a really good understanding of people's perspective. And beyond listening, you want to use that feedback to shape strategies and the work that actually gets done. And so speaking to United Way, what we do with United Way, and you actually referenced one of the events that we've pulled together working with the police department. In our engagement activities, when we speak with neighborhood residents, you know, probably understandably, some people don't have good interactions with police. And so what we want to do is create less adversarial interactions between police and members of the community. So we had great leadership at the police department, and they were very receptive to this idea of a set of block parties where we bring public safety officials and community residents together to have, you know, more positive interactions. And I think it worked out really well. We called them Strong Neighborhood Days. We had six block parties in some of the most critical, challenged neighborhoods in our community. I think they turned out really well. So they kind of served a couple of different purposes. They were intended to help people connect with each other and also create positive interactions between police and members in the community. And, we got great feedback from attendees and citizens. We had Zamudo's Granita at each event, and, you know, that's always a hit. the police were out with the short shorts and everything, you know, so it wasn't, it felt different. And I think it was good for people to see and be able to interact with public safety officials in a different capacity. And so we're kind of working on a front end with people in communities to try to create those opportunities for people to see the human being, and also for police to see, you know, the families that are living in some of these conditions. So that's what we're doing from the United Way side.
And from the My Brother's Keeper side, mm-hmm. You're also working with younger generations to keep them from getting into the life of crime. And so what kind of things are you doing? What gets them into a life of violence?
Well, in terms of steps that we've been taking from MBK, we've been trying to raise awareness and advocate for the experiences and positions that young boys and men of color find themselves in. We've done that through this series of community conversations and town halls. We call them Real Talk MBK. We've held two such events so far, and the intention is to allow people in a community to talk with each other and raise up their concerns and their issues amongst one another. We do have a panel on the front end, but you know that's not the primary intention of the event. It's really about how can you allow people to feel more empowered to discuss the things that are happening to them. And again, we always try to capture those comments and use that feedback to shape strategies. So MBK is trying to do that, help people, you know, speak to their experience and share it with their neighbors and with the community. I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
So the question was, why do young people engage sometimes in criminal activities? I think, you know, that's a multi-layered it's a multi-layered response, of course. But I think one of the things I see is young people don't see themselves in, you know, the opportunities that are kind of presented, you know. So I don't see myself in, you know, we say, just go to school every day, you know, get your education, you'll be fine. Just work hard, get yourself a job, you'll be all right, you know, and stay out of trouble. Well, it's hard for some of our young people to kind of see themselves succeeding when they don't have positive interaction with the teacher. You know, they feel like the teacher doesn't like me. I don't think this teacher really believes in my ability to succeed. I look outside of my house and I don't see economic opportunities. I don't see work centers close to my house. I don't see myself in these systems that are presented to me. So where do I go? I go where I see myself. I go where I feel better and feel more comfortable. And I think that's good as long as people aren't being hurt and people's lives aren't being imposed on. But we see that, you know, sometimes it kind of gets twisted and it goes the wrong way.
Is there another person on the panel who'd like to talk about what brings the younger generation into criminal violent activity and what can be done?
I just recently read, which is sort of intriguing, and some work that's taking place in Charlotte and Mecklenburg. There was a psychiatrist that was talking about young crime, young suspects. And so some of the research that's been done on the young offender is that some young offenders is that they're seeing a sort of cycle in their family where Judge Collins is here and done great work with our local domestic violence, but unfortunately there are young children that are experiencing domestic violence in their home, and they may see the mother or father being battered. They may be seeing a brother or sister being killed. And this is sort of having some psychological impact on the child. And the child's not being treated properly, so then the child becomes sort of in this survival mode. And instead of thinking about, as Mr. Simpson said, about, you know, what's going to happen in 5 years from now or what my goals are, at times the research has shown that the goal is survival for the day. And they don't have the economic means to get out of the situation that they're in. So intriguing work in Charlotte and Mecklenburg Police Department to work in a collaborative mode with what somewhat similar like our Illinois Department of Children and Family Services is to respond immediately to those situations where there are young children and give them the particular services. And just further, the police department's made a number of arrests, unfortunately, on some very young individuals who were robbing some elderly individuals. And so we look back at that, don't have all the sort of digging down, but half of those kids, when I call kids, 12 to I think as low as 12 years old up to 17, half of them were on juvenile probation. Mm. And not for jaywalking or not for toilet paper in somebody's house, but for robbery, for assault. And I have to sit back after I read that article thinking, okay, how many of those kids could potentially, young children, sort of be in this mode with this psychiatrist was talking about, is that they're, you know, they're sort of dysfunctional in the brain because of the violence and the things that they've seen. So it's really a future of Rockford. I talked about it the other night. And as a community, we really need to address not in some study that's going to come out 5 years from now. Mm-hmm. We really need to address the causes soon on our young mm-hmm. Juvenile crime because, unfortunately, as we sort of roundtable it at work, those young children will become now victims and suspects in domestic violence situations. And certainly that sort of goes vertical. Now you're going to see some violent crime with those individuals, not only as a youth, but also as an mm-hmm. adult.
Yes. Well, when we start to look at the things that the two gentlemen just said, you're absolutely right on. As a psychologist, maladaptive behavior is cyclical. You witness it, you repeat it, you keep doing it time and time again. I think another thing that Mr. Simpson pointed to is the educational environment. We have our students who are exposed to an education system that often does not reflect them in any way, not learning their own cultural history, not having teachers or administrators or staff who look like them, who they can say, well, one day I would like to do this as a profession. One day I want to be a teacher. So we know that children look for these role models, and either those role models are going to be positive or they're going to be negative. And if they're stuck in a cycle or in a community that's stuck in a cycle of violence, then it's not much longer before they are part of it. As a legislator, I've supported a bill that would do away with the zero tolerance policies in our schools. I think far too early we are criminalizing the behavior of children. I think that for the most heinous things, yes, remove them from the learning environment so that we can protect the other students in the environment. But for some of the things that students have been removed from the learning environment over, we only are detaching them from school so that they have parents who are at work throughout the day or no adult supervision. Who's taking care of them while they're in these 3-day suspensions? What activities are they getting involved in when they are disconnected from the learning environment? And so Senate Bill 100 just was signed into law as well, and it will dismantle zero tolerance policies and start to give schools a basis for which they need to look at other ways to discipline children. Try various methods before you just kick them out of the learning environment, which is consistent with what educational psychologists say, what some of the national organizations on education say. Disengaging students from the learning environment only puts them in a position where they have access, mm-hmm. Time, and nothing else to do. But, you know, who knows? If they don't have the right environment already, they're going to make bad decisions. Also, as a legislator, I'm fighting to make sure that we can fund our teen reach programs and after-school programs so that children and young adults have constructive places to be, again, keeping them away from the streets and out of situations where they're exposed to behavior that they may want to emulate that's not good.
I think this is the longest I've gone in a long time without speaking, so it's I'm
How's
trying to be a better
okay?
listener. Good, I'm doing good. All kidding aside, this is, amongst our challenges involving violent crime, there's nothing more sad than the suffering that our juveniles go through, and it's also sad the trauma that they have themselves experienced many times, but also the trauma that they're inflicting in the cycle that Representative Wallace referenced. So there's a pastor that has been working with our police department for years closely, and he's a good friend, Pastor K. Edward Copeland. And he has described some of the dysfunction that I think is within our systems that make it hard for us to help each other and help in particular juveniles. And he said, you know, Rockford's not so much divided as we are disconnected. And one of the challenges, how do you make the connection? There's so many different systems at the state, the local level, county level, probation, parole. When you start dealing with juveniles, there's many laws designed to protect and support juveniles that end up being a shield, actually preventing caregivers from working collaboratively and effectively together. I think we can take on those bureaucratic challenges, those organizational challenges, but we need to act differently. We need to be organized differently. The model that I've been espousing and working with Pastor Copeland on is based on the principles that have been working with the local Alignment Rockford group, designed to support the community connecting and being more effective with the Rockford Public Schools. So if you take those principles known as collective impact, this is not, to our knowledge, really been done anywhere we can tell at the local level when it comes to public safety and violent crime. But if you take those principles of collective impact, and we've talked about doing it under a name we've called Connect Rockford, and you bring together law enforcement, you bring together human and social services agencies across federal, state, and local levels, and you align it with a backbone organization driving accountability, then as my dad likes to say, if it might help and it won't hurt, let's give it a try. So we're in the process, hopefully we'll have it finalized in the next few days, several of us and partners in the community, to hire a project manager and start to do the exploratory work about building this Connect Rockford partnership. My hope is that one of the initial challenges we'll take on is juvenile justice and use some of the same principles that we've been working effectively. We're not there yet, but we're making progress on adult reentry, reconnecting adults from probation and parole into our community and trying to find jobs and opportunities. It's easier, frankly, to do for adults than it is children. You may think that's strange, but there's fewer bureaucratic barriers and fewer laws that prevent us from talking to one another. So my energies are being put into this initiative because I'm tired of the blame game. It doesn't work. We could blame the schools. We could blame the city. You know, I talk about the C's, cops, courts, corrections, community, and finally credibility. There is no credibility in a system that doesn't have mutually shared goals and accountability across all of those areas. So I'm excited about it. It's something you'll be hearing more about in the coming days and weeks ahead. We've got a lot of good initiatives, a lot of good activities that are happening. My hope is that we can pull them together in a little bit more effective strategy to progress, and especially focused on our challenges with our young people.
Thank you. And I hope I didn't sound like, you know, by jumping to the question about kids so early in this, mm-hmm. that we're blaming them because mm-hmm. obviously it's a community mm-hmm. issue. So just so that's clear, you know, this is a...
You have a long line to get in if you want to start blaming me, but I understand what you're trying to say.
I wasn't going to blame
you. I know. I'm just kidding.
I know that. Okay. So, Chief Epperson, the debate, even the racially charged debate over officer-involved shootings nationwide, has it changed how the Rockford Police Department recruits, trains, and even assigns officers?
So for the last few years, we have, since the Mark Anthony Barmore shooting since 2009, we called in an independent to review the independent assessment monitoring, two civil rights attorneys, looked at that shooting and looked at the policies and protocols of the Rockford Police Department, and came up with 33 recommendations. And we were fortunately able to implement 31 out of the 33 in 18 months. Mm. And also, and that's remarkable time. Usually that would take maybe 5 or 10 years. And that was without any court intervention. That was hard work of the department, the community, and the whole city leadership. One of the other things that came out of that shooting is that we're set up now. It was Winnebago County. Now it's Winnebago Boone. If there is a officer-involved shooting, a level of force that is serious, or some other reason, chief or sheriff, for instance, if there's internal theft, you know, something that raises to a criminal level, that we can request the independent investigation, criminal investigation of that shooting. So we've had several officer-involved shootings since 2009 that have been independently investigated by detectives outside of Rockford. And let me just be real clear. Calling the Integrity Task Force is not indicating wrongdoing. So there is some information in the community, and it's been said publicly in the paper that, well, we don't call them in because there's no wrongdoing. It's not about wrongdoing. It's about independently looking at a police investigation without having that involved agency. That's a best practice. That's contemporary policing. This is what's taken place across the United States of America. It's President Obama's 21st Century Initiative, also the state of Illinois. Black Lives Matter, we've been doing this since 2009. We're proud of it. It takes tremendous pressure off the police department when it's independently looked at. Answer your, I believe your second question is that hurt in terms of us attracting minority representation in the police department? I think that was your second question. So this last list that we finally posted, 30 candidates, half of them were minorities, first time ever. Great job of our recruiters. Went out and hit many, many places. Not literally hit, but went out and went in those doors and made great connections. And so, you know, I look at that and I look at our Explorer post. If our Explorer post were to come in here and present the colors, it's a true reflection of the...
Explain what Explorers...
Yeah, the Explorer post is for ages 14 to 21. If you would like to be interested in law enforcement, do you want to see how law enforcement operates, wear a uniform, learn some life skills, some civility, teamwork, they do team competition, it's free. We meet twice a month. It's a great group of individuals from Rockford schools, public schools, private schools, and we even have some students that are involved in that are not in Rockford. So to answer your question, no. Matter of fact, the Integrity Task Force, and I'll just go back, since the Barmore shooting, the Rockford Police Department is a much better department today than we were in the past few years. We're getting better. We've enhanced our policy, our training, our supervision, and our discipline, and we're in a very, very good spot today.
Thanks. Does Rockford... By the way, we're going to get to audience questions pretty soon. But and again, if you've got questions on a card, please just wave them, and a coworker will come grab them and get them to me. Also, we will start with the our two people who are going to be carrying around some microphones and letting you ask your question. But back to me. Here comes a question. Okay, thank you. Collaborations. What kind of collaborations does Rockford have within Winnebago County, maybe even outside Winnebago County, to work on community safety, that sort of thing?
You know, I'll jump in only because I'll give the chief a chance to catch his breath and then hand it over to him because he's got a lot more of the detail on it. But I've been very proud of the work we've done, you know, starting in 2013. Senator Durbin came to town and hosted a discussion supporting the idea of federal, state, and local partners growing our law enforcement partnerships. Out of that conversation grew what is now known as the Winnebago County Violent Crime Task Force. We recently announced that that has been expanded to include leadership on the intelligence side and on the investigative side from the local FBI agent, local FBI presence, and they have an outstanding agent in charge who has been supportive of digging in, doing more collaborative law enforcement investigations and police work. So there's a lot of collaboration that has been growing on the law enforcement side. You may have just heard that the sheriff has hosted a couple press conferences really recently talking about some of the saturation details that are done. There's a street crimes presence which is going out looking at hot areas of the city, and then we also have had a growing recognition that it's not just about looking at hot spot policing. It's a term of art you may have heard championed many years ago in New York City, and it's now really a very common phrase and a way of doing policing. But there's been, over the last few years, a growing emphasis not just on hot spots but on hot people. So the work that we're doing across agencies is trying to identify those individuals that are at risk of committing crime or being a victim of a crime. I just gave a talk on this with some of our police department analysts and personnel recently. We've invested in analytics that allow us to scope and research social media. We're analyzing networks of individuals and trying to identify who's at risk and then trying to customize the ability to reach out to those folks in advance. This is something we're still developing. But try to be in a more prevention-based mode to intervene, to support better choices being made, and hopefully cut off some of the problems before they occur. So I'm comfortable, and I think we're making a lot of progress on partnerships at the law enforcement level, where we really feel, I think we've exposed a lot of gaps. And by the way, on September 22nd, there's going to be a review given by the Department of Justice that's been involved over the last, Chief, 12 months, 15 months, mm-hmm. doing a deep dive into our local challenges in violent crime. And they'll be issuing a report identifying some of the gaps. Many of those we've, by the way, that's a product and a part of the support we've received from the White House Strong Cities Initiative. We're an SC2 city. But that work, we think, will align very well with what we've already been recognizing, that we have a number of gaps that are in some in law enforcement, but the bigger gaps happen to be in the disconnect between, let's say, juvenile justice, human services and social services, and law enforcement. So that's the Department of Corrections, that's probation, that's parole, that's the human and social services folks, that's our schools. That's an area that I think we have a lot of room to improve upon. There are some best practices that we could deploy, we think, and I'll be looking forward to that event in September to help give us some guidance and some directions that we can go. Again, it's not saying that we're not doing a lot of good things, but it's just many times those things that we're doing are disconnected, so we're not really a whole as we are a lot of parts.
I'd like to go ahead and jump in with the fact that I created a Rockford Violent Crime Task Force, which seeks to bring the bodies that the mayor just spoke about together along with business partners, other areas of law enforcement such as parole, probation, allowing for a research component to be part of that with professors from criminal justice and from sociology, an appointee from the governor. The mayor has appointing authority, and so does the Winnebago County Violent Crime Task Force, so that there are law enforcement agents as well as part of this. The point is to kind of look at what's going on, what are some of the root causes of the violence that's happening in our community, and the ultimate goal would be to suggest whether or not the state police needs to have a greater presence here, which they have collaborated with the Winnebago County Violent Crime Task Force. And also, what policies, what legislation would perhaps be born of the suggestions that come from this research? What are some of the things that perhaps I need to introduce or work with other legislators that will, what can I introduce and what policies can we create that will help to reduce the violent crime that we see? And when we speak about violent crime, I think it's really important to note, and Judge Collins and I have had this conversation, that it's not just what we see on the evening news, right? Every night or every other night we hear about a shooting or some type of gang violence, but violent crime also includes the sexual assaults that occur, domestic violence that happens, aggravated battery. So there's any number of things that fall into that category. So if we're thinking, there's this gang task force already mm-hmm. with the Winnebago County Violent Crime Task Force. Well, this is a little more broad in scope, and we want to just make sure that we're giving attention to all of the categories of violent crime and working to find ways to curb those crimes.
I think one of the to answer your question, take a little different approach and then get to the question, but in order to do external crime fighting, you have to sort of have your house in order. So our department is into our third accreditation through the Commission on Accreditation of Police Departments across the country. So we're less than 5% of police agencies across the country are accredited. What does that mean? We have policy, standards, procedures, what we have in place. We actually get audited, so there's 450 standards. So, for instance, there has to be a standard for use of force. Do we use the appropriate level of force? Do we have an open complaint system? So can individuals who want to complain against a Rockford police officer, is their complaint heard? Is it heard by an open complaint system so you can be an anonymous complainant, or can you do an online complaint? And is there a remediation, adjudication of that complaint? Do you want to compliment an officer? We have that, that process also open. So many things internally have taken place in order to get our house in order before we can actually go out and get into other houses. But as the mayor said, we work collaboratively with the FBI, the Winnebago County Sheriff's Department, and the Lewis Park Police Department on a task force looking at gang activity, high-end criminals that are repeat offenders, street-level long-term investigations. We have a relationship with the Illinois Department of Corrections. They meet with us every Friday at 8:30. We go over those individuals that are on parole. We also work with the Winnebago County Court System on those individuals that are on probation. The last thing is that we're really proud about is that you can go to our website, rockfordil.gov/police. All of our data in terms of who we stop, our bias-based policing report is online. Our complaint process is online, along with our policies. So all of our police policies that we have, whether it be use of force, whether it be our code of conduct, they're online. And so you can see exactly what the police department is doing or should be doing.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to go to one of the questions that I've had handed to me this evening. So I'm going to combine a couple here. So it's about the multi-jurisdictional task force. What kind of budget for that? How does that break down between municipal, sheriff's department, state? And will they be using aerial surveillance on a continual basis?
So the if I'm getting this question, so it would be the criminal multi the crime aspect, not the integrity task force.
Right.
Okay. So the funding on that is our personnel from the police department. So we on a temporary basis, or we call it TDY, we send those two detectives over to the FBI office. So we're not paying any more, because if those detectives were in our building doing other duties, we're going to pay their salaries. So they just happen to go over and work on violent crime. In terms of budgeting, there is no budgeting. It's the taxpayer personnel dollars. We're just allocating those resources to go to work in a collaborative mode with county, state, and federal authorities to look at high-end criminals that actually, they're not just committing one armed robbery, they're multiple armed robberies, multiple victims and suspects. In terms of aerial, we don't have a drone. I think the state police has a drone. I haven't seen the drone here operating in Rockford. I know we use helicopters and air surveillance, but if there is a drone, I wouldn't talk about it if we were using it. So we wouldn't want to give any sort of secrets out or a plane. But let me just go back for a second. There's no drone.
There's no drone.
So we don't have a drone.
I think, Chief, the state police helicopter was brought in over the weekend. That's not part of our budget. I don't
right.
know how the state manages that budget.
If we have a high-end, if we have a barricaded subject or a pursuit, or you need some assistance from the state police, they have a helicopter and a state plane. It'd take minutes, half hour or so to get here. Let me just go back a second. One thing that hasn't been mentioned is that before our time, and it's going to be after our time, there's a thing called the Constitution. And our department adheres to the Constitution. If we get outside the four corners of the Constitution, then we've got a problem. So I've been to some community meetings recently where some comments, and I was taken back that, we need to hassle some of the violent crime offenders. This department is not going to hassle anyone. Because when we start hassling individuals, then we start bending the Constitution. And when we bend the Constitution, we got a lot of problems. So regardless if you're a hardened criminal, you're a law-abiding citizen, you're a gang member, you're a convicted 10-time felon, we're going to treat everybody with respect. And if you do do a crime, and we put an investigation against you, then we will take you through the system. But in terms of hassling, bending the Constitution, this department in this city is not going to bend the Constitution.
If I could, just to jump in, the question on the helicopter specifically is one It would probably be better to ask either the state police or the sheriff, because I think the sheriff coordinated a lot of the resources that were brought in. Those resources may be appropriate and called for, and I don't want to judge the field operations folks who are doing that. I would just say this to back up what the chief said. I would put our practices up against any in the nation right now. The work that just became, and it's under SB 1304, the bill that just passed, Section 20-150 and 160 deal with stop and what we call civilians tend to call stop and frisk. They call field interviews. Those field interviews now in the law enforcement, that's what they're called, FIs, field interviews. That's the term of art. Mm-hmm. But when you do a field interview in Rockford Police Department starting this year, and Chief, to correct me if I'm wrong on this, we keep track of all those field interviews. We actually have a report that we will have done for 2014.
We started 2015.
So now, good news for us, we already started that practice. It's mandated now under the new state law. So next year, not only will we have to be, we're in good shape because we've already been doing this. The one addition we'll have to do starting next year is to hand a receipt to every individual who gets stopped so that they have information on the name of the officer that stopped them, their badge number, some other basic information that they'll get. To me, this provides credibility for all law enforcement, and I'm proud that our police department is already doing this and going in this direction. We'll have a report that will be published on a regular basis. I don't know if we'll do it quarterly or biannually or what, where we will give the same level of detail on a field interview, stop and frisk incident, as we would on our bias-based policing report. It's actually part of the State Department of Transportation code because we've already been doing this. All law enforcement have been mandated for many years in Illinois to keep track of that data when you pull someone over. You got to keep track of their race. You've got to be able to validate whether you're doing it at a rate that's higher than the population for the area and the community. There's a lot of detail in that. That same rules will be applied to when you do a stop and frisk, a field interview. Like I said, I think that's a good thing. It provides credibility, but ultimately it's basic adherence to the Constitution.
Okay. And I'm going to ask another question that I received. But first, I'd like to just kind of get a question from the audience set up. So if there's someone who would like to ask a question, we'll get to you right after this one. So, okay, we'll go to Matthew. Domestic violence. I'm reading the card as it is. Domestic violence is a crime that affects everyone in our community, rich, middle class, poor, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, employed, unemployed, everyone. He's a good writer. Can you speak to how you're dealing with this growing community problem? And actually, I'd like to start at the end with Matthew.
I think, it's a private matter. What happens in people's homes is a private matter. So, you know, it's not like we can just kind of burst into people's houses and, you know, tell people what to do. But it's important, I think, that we have to do better in our, it kind of speaks to the mayor's comment about being disconnected as opposed to being divided. And I think it also has to do with where people feel supported. You know, do people feel that they can invest their trust and support in some of our organizations and institutions? I think we need to do better at reaching out and following up, you know, identifying those red flags that may indicate a person is struggling with some of these domestic issues. I think it's kind of how the mayor said, sometimes we're in our own way. These systems and these organizations tend to be barriers for us, you know, because our money stops here. We can't reach that way. We can't, you know, make that extra call. We can't spend that extra amount of time that's needed to help meet a need that exists. I was talking to Delisha Harris about how can we do better to respond to things like domestic violence and to things like violence that has been taking place on the street. And she was saying, you know, we got to do better in our organizations. And she just, you know, about following up. How do we follow up with people? How do we reach out and connect with people while they're in their situation? She just mentioned that, you know, who's really good at following up is the police. The police will come and knock on your door when they get that service call, when there's that warrant issued. The police are excellent, you know, and they have it built into their system. They follow up very well, but we don't. She was talking about, you know, human services and a lot of our nonprofit partners. We have to do better to make the reach that's necessary to help a person respond to the situation they exist in. So that's what I'll say to that.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Is this open to anybody? I didn't know if it was going right down the line. I would like to speak to the domestic violence issue. I think in the beginning of Mr. Simpson's answer, it might have seemed as if it's not an issue that's a community issue. So while it may occur in many times behind closed doors and in the dark, it is, as he stated, it's incumbent upon us as community members to make sure that we are recognizing red flags. We're looking when we see our coworker who is bruised or coming in late or her or his behavior has changed differently or radically since being involved in whatever relationship they're in. Children are part of this equation as well. So we look at child abuse and domestic violence as two separate things. I believe they're all one thing. And we need to be looking, as we do as mandated reporters, we look for the abuse in our children. We need to do that when it comes to just our coworkers, our partners, our neighbors, the people in our lives. We also have to create supportive systems. We can't blame the victim. Mm-hmm. We can't say, well, why did she stay so long? Or why did he allow her to do that to him? Or let's recognize that there are same-sex relationships, that there's domestic violence mm-hmm. that are that's occurring. How can we give people support? One new way of supporting individuals, Senator Solomon and I passed legislation to allow for utility companies to give people a 60-day kind of deferral of their utility deposits. In many situations, people are trapped in these situations of violence and cycles of violence because they can't leave, because they don't have the resources to do so. But if we can provide resources, if we can provide support, and just anything for to allow for that victim to leave the violent situation that they're in, every little bit that we can do will help ultimately save a life. And so that legislation allows for an individual, for example, to move out. This will help women or men who are already in shelters be able to get into their own home and away from their abuser. And maybe they don't have the dollars right now to set up their utilities, but it will defer it for them and allow them to do what they need to do to provide for their families as they transition into a safer lifestyle. But please know that domestic violence is an issue for everybody. All of us should be concerned about it, and we need to stop thinking of it in the way that we have for centuries, which is what goes on between that couple goes on between that couple, and we don't want to get involved. It's always time to get involved.
It's one of the most important, not one of the most important, can be one of the most dangerous calls that a law enforcement responds to. So we respond to all domestic violence calls, and the police department is very fortunate to have a dedicated domestic violence unit that works in collaboration with the state's attorney's office and also Judge Collins and the coordinating court. I know the judge brought some handouts on community resources for families. She has that here. There's services that are provided countywide, and we work in a collaborative mode with the state's attorney's office and the court. One of the things, I just apologize, I don't know the when we're going to start that, but we're going to have a targeted area. I know we've worked with Judge Collins to be able to have a test site in Rockford. What I'm saying is that when we respond to a call, what we found, the research has indicated this, the sooner that you can get those services to that victim, the less likelihood there's going to be recidivism and reoffended again with the offender and the victim. So we're going to be having a pilot area working with the police department to have some of our areas in Rockford be able to provide those services. And again, I apologize, I don't have the update, but I know it's going to be soon. And we've been, working with the judge on that for a few months now.
We do have an expert, nationally recognized expert locally, in Judge Collins and her work with domestic violence. We're trying to do a better job, frankly, in law enforcement to be supportive partners. If you think about it, we're first responders to every domestic violence call when we get the call. that may be a call from a response from our police department, also maybe our fire department, depending on the severity of the violence and what's involved. And what we want to do is make sure our first responders have an opportunity to be a much more effective partner. And that means having training to support evidence-based inquiry, asking questions, and then being able to make a referral. And otherwise, in the past, you know, frankly, our officers are so swamped, so busy, they're going from call to call, and we, you know, there may be someone who's got training, and we do have a lot of training to be supportive of officers when they're trying to investigate these domestic violence cases. But we know by our experience and experiences around the nation, we just haven't had the most effective handoff to the counseling and the support services that they may very well desperately need. So that's something we're working on right now. We hope also on the fire department, not just police department, through a thing called mobile integrated health, that we could, when we recognize, because our fire department is responding, paramedics are responding, you know, it could be a call for a variety of things, but the future of healthcare is intersecting directly with law enforcement. And we've got a partnership. We're hoping to have more to talk about it in the coming weeks with the University of Illinois College of Medicine so that we can be bring in the research and the support to make sure that on an ongoing basis we can be as effective as we can with our local resources and keep improving. These are very challenging situations.
Thank you.
I just want to clarify my comment. I appreciate Dr. Wallace kind of shining light. My intentions in saying that it's a private matter is that, you know, when we talk about violent crime, unlike gun violence, you know, it's not as easy to identify. And sometimes people want to hold that information closer to themselves. That was my intention of making that comment. But, of course, it is a very serious issue that the community needs to take better care of, identifying those red flags to respond to.
Thank you. And we want to get to Matthew's question, but I saw hands go up over here when we started talking about domestic violence. Is this a follow-up?
I have a really simple question. I mean, it really requires a short answer, I think. Okay.
Okay, if you could state your name, your city, that'd be great.
You know who I am. I'm Millie Zimmerman. I live in Rockford. I live on the west side, and I have two things on my mind tonight, which are really very simple. I don't feel unsafe, and I'm annoyed by the people who are running around saying that they're unsafe. And I don't feel unsafe. Maybe I'm really lucky, but I live on the west side. I don't feel unsafe. Secondly, though, I really want to know, is there a marked increase in crime in the last year or so? And is there a shift from crime being pretty much people commit crimes against someone they know, or do we have a marked increase in random sort of, you know, shoot somebody in the street? So that's two parts. One, I just needed to say tonight that I personally don't feel unsafe in Rockford, and that's a thank you to Chief Everson and the police.
Thanks.
Well, I want to really thank you for making that comment. That's remarkable. We've known each other for years, so appreciate that. So you raise sort of an interesting question, the rise of crime. What's interesting is that last year we had our all-time low, at least last 10 or 15 years on crime. Overall crime, 2014, was the lowest. You wouldn't believe that because, you know, if you see shootings in the news or the media or the newspaper, that sort of sensationalism and Twitter, Facebook, and people get on the rampage about this, and that. But 2014 had the lowest amount of crime. Now, the violent crime over the last few years has increased. And I'm not going to say this okay, but I had a statewide chiefs meeting today. Elgin, Springfield, Joliet, Urbana, and Champaign have all had increases in violent crime. And guess what they are? Young people shooting. Their shots fired up across the whole state of Illinois. So this isn't just a Rockford issue. We're not like on an island here and we're just, you know, everybody's shooting each other. Unfortunately, this is a urban crime issue, and it's not only in the state of Illinois. We're seeing this across the United States of America. Your second question you asked, which is very good, about the suspect-victim relationship. That's what I think that you were asking.
Exactly.
So what we find is in some 80 to 85% of our homicides, once we make an arrest on a murder, suspect and victim knew each other. We don't have sort of this Ray Lee Stewart years ago, I'm aging myself, where he's around shooting people, and there was sort of one person out shooting, 80, 85% roughly right around there. Once we find, we make the arrest, the suspect and the victim know each other, either through domestic violence, either through some sort of argument. We find the same thing with, of course, family fights. Those are going to be sort of suspect-victim relationship, where you'll see where it'll sort of spread out and it won't be higher is the robberies. So what we've seen recently in the first 6 months of this year is the robberies with some of our young youths that are targeting some of our elderly people. And so they don't know each other, but they obviously foul that that person and then end up robbing them. Assaults, the suspect-victim relationship is high.
If I can, just to make sure to clarify, our overall crime rate last year was one of the lowest we've had, and it's been on an ongoing trend downward. That includes part A, B crimes, property crimes, violent crimes. The sticky, very difficult thing we've had, which is what causes the most fear, and I don't want to challenge or question anybody who feels fearful. My heart goes out to them because it's an emotion. It is what it is. But I would tell you that I live on the west side, too. I just live down the street, North Church Street, and I love my neighborhood, love my house. I don't feel fearful when I go to bed at night either. That being said, I'm very aware, both as a dad, a husband, and as a mayor, that we've got too much violent crime in our community, and we need to do everything we can to reduce it. But that doesn't include creating fear when there shouldn't be fear. And we've had a heck of a lot of fear-mongering going on, not just here but across the country, to try to, and it's sad because sometimes it's coming from leaders. So my goal is to try to be as accurate as I possibly can. That's why you hear me clarifying, because I want to deal with the truth and the facts as they are and then dig into and deal with the underlying challenges that we have. We have very difficult, about a quarter of our crime, violent crime, is domestic on any given month. So you want to know why, if for no other reason, it may not touch your life, it is one of the biggest things that puts us over the hump when we compare ourselves to the other lower violent crime cities. They don't have this much domestic violence. And there's a lot of social reasons and others that we go into it, but that's something we're working on and need to all work on. The juvenile piece, I'll just mention again, that's where we've had an uptick in these random robberies, strong-arm robberies, not always involving a gun, but someone taking advantage of someone. It hasn't always been elderly, but there have been a number of elderly, including women, being taken advantage of when they're at risk. They're out by themselves, they get overpowered, whatever. So we have been very concerned about that. And I just want to say this. This is why the juvenile justice piece is such a stark thing for us. Every juvenile we arrest gets taken to an assessment center. And the question is, do you book them? Do they get lodged in the detention center? They get assessed. Do they get lodged or do they get let back to their parents? It's a tough thing because there's overcrowding in the little kids' jail, right, the juvenile jail, when we got a lot of beds in the adult jail. There was a state law that changed, and it's very important that we get this out, that now 17-year-olds who used to be able to go to the adult facility have to be lodged. Did I get this right, Chief? I think that's accurate, in the juvenile facility. Mm-hmm. So that by itself was a big contributor to the overcrowding. There's a series of challenges. What we don't want to have happen is have a system in which the best case scenario is letting a child back to a parent that probably had trouble monitoring and managing them in the first place, right? So those are some of the sticky, tough issues that we're dealing with. And it really, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. These are ones that we need to come together and collaborate to try to find the most effective solutions.
Anyone else in the panel want to make a comment on that? Okay. Let's state your name and city and make
a right. question. I'm Matthew Johnson. I'm the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church here in Rockford. I'll say first, before I ask the question, that a lot of my colleagues have been doing civil rights, Black Lives Matter work all around the country, and they would give anything to have a department, elected officials, who are as committed to doing this right as y'all are. So I just want to say, I've talked to them. They were jealous. They're in places like Ferguson and other places around the country where there's no commitment. There's active resistance. And I know it's not easy. We're not there. But Thank you for that. And so the question I have is that a group of Black Lives Matter activists introduced what they call Campaign Zero to eliminate police violence in this country. And it includes things that we can do, 10 areas, things like civilian oversight, stricter limits on the use of force, better training, reporting, ending militarization, and for-profit policing, some others. Some of the items are similar to what's in the new statewide bill you all have talked about, and some of them are things you've already implemented over the last 4, 5, 6 years. Others are things we're not doing here yet, and I'd like to know from you if you, to the extent you've had a chance to look at that agenda, if you endorse the agenda, if not all of it, which parts of it you think are next for us in that work?
You know, the chief and I talked briefly about this afternoon, anticipating it coming up as a question. And I would just say I did have a chance to review the recommendations. I don't remember them all by heart. But I would tell you, we are moving forward on, I would say, the majority of the initiatives. And most importantly, we're committed to the same goal, which is reducing unnecessary police use of force. And that, for a very important reason, supports safety for our citizens and our officers. From 2009 to 2014, we've roughly cut in half the number of incidents where police have had to use force in the apprehension of an individual. That means that our officers and community members are statistically going to be safer. Now, I've been asked the question, well, doesn't it mean perhaps that we're putting limits on our officers' use of force? And yes, by definition, we are, and we manage the heck out of that, monitor it, but it's done for a very important reason, which is to make sure that we're practicing constitutional policing and we're making sure we're doing everything we can to assure that an officer will go home safely to their families, and that individuals who are treated fairly in our community. I'll tell you where, however, I differ a little bit. There's some fairly blanket statements at the start of a few of the items in the agenda that I would parse. I wouldn't say it so basic and straightforward, because I don't think that's accurate. So the comment was one of the items was end broken windows policing. That is broken windows policing encompasses a lot of different things depending on the department you talk to. So I wouldn't say end broken windows policing. I would say follow the Constitution if you're going to practice managing what some people might call small things. So if someone's littering, which is one of the things that they'll talk about within broken windows, is, you know, you write a citation for littering. This is something we did a lot of this in my first term in office, and I'm very proud that we did. But it also means if someone, after you give them the citation, crumples it up and throws it on the ground, you don't put them in a chokehold, right? So you pick what you might do is pick it up and say, hey, we'll see you in court. You know, have a good day, right? But because it's just not worth it. So that's something that we have to make sure in law enforcement we train the heck out of and we manage. And what we have now, and it didn't say it come up before, but I'll mention, this actually started, and we got a cooperation with the police union before the Barmore incident to put in place what we call an early warning system. So we actually keep track of every incident of use of force. That, by the way, is going to make it easy for us to produce our reporting. We'll be able to give a lot more detailed reporting than the state actually mandates in the new bill. But we manage that so that we can hopefully engage and provide training and support for an officer who maybe just needs some guidance. And I feel for those departments that aren't doing the type of training and monitoring and support, because they won't have the skills they need when under stress. And Representative Wallace, I know this is her specialty in her PhD, you know, psychology. When you're under stress, you do things differently. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure our officers, when they're under stress, have had the training to support the best possible decision-making in those very difficult situations. So, like I said, I'm proud of the work that we've done. There's a lot of good things within the agenda of the Black Lives Matter. We just would probably have some differences on the nuances of it.
One of the things in the Black Lives Matter is community oversight. And then in the President's 21st Commission talks about specifically adding civilians that are trained to look at police oversight. So it's come a day in law enforcement that we in law enforcement have to sort of take a step back and say, It's time that we have our citizens that are in our community become part of our active review of force cases and discipline cases. And certainly there's going to be, you know, some legal issues internally. But if we really take a step back, both, you know, police union, police management, it's time that we embrace the community who are very educated. We're only going to become stronger as a police force when we allow the community to come inside of our police station to see what's taking place in terms of discipline, use of force, shooting investigations. And as long as those civilians are trained and they'll be able to look, articulate, then we have a better supporting police department. So I'd be very open to that in the future. I embrace any sort of community oversight. I'm not talking about just hiring discipline. I'm actually talking about getting community members that are trained, as the president has said in his commission, to be able to do that. It's a long hurdle, but we should certainly be open to that.
So, this would be the Community Citizen Oversight Commission.
You know, certainly if the commission is set up correctly, if there's checks and balances that are in there, right. And not to use subpoena power, to use that conservatively or liberally, but for the right reasons, certainly, you know, it's not my decision, but I'm certainly open to that. You've looked in the president's commission. The more that you can get the citizens involved, the better that you're going to have people that are going to trust the police. Yeah. So it's come a day that we need to certainly look at things like that.
Just from my standpoint, we actually talked in detail about that after the Barmore shooting when we had a mediation with the Department of Justice. There's some issues involving our collective bargaining agreements that we'd have to deal with. But if it was, I think it could be done effectively, and I would have no problem having subpoena power. And I would just say this. The state's attorney already has the power to get documents when there's a criminal investigation. The way the independent investigations go on, if it's a serious enough incident, when you have the integrity task force, they could go after and get whatever they need to do from an investigative standpoint. We're typically talking about something when it's being reviewed internally that's probably not a death investigation. It could be an administrative review after a death investigation, but when we're bringing the civilian component to it, a review, I would have no problem as long as the chief said, the checks and balances are put in place, and obviously we'd have to make sure it comports with our collective bargaining agreements.
I'd like to speak to the Black Lives Matters, just one moment. I was in Ferguson last August, and I remember making and drawing the parallels between Ferguson in 2014 and the city of Rockford in August of 2009. And I've often marveled at how we did not become Ferguson. Mm. If you remember the climate after the Barmore shooting, if you remember the angst, if you remember just the feel of the city at that time, then you know that I think we were right on the cusp of that. Mm-hmm. I think it is because there were people who made concerted efforts, and as you stated, that there are people who are actually willing to address the issues instead of resist the issues. I think those are the reasons why we did not end up Ferguson 2009. And so instead of talking about Ferguson, we'd be talking about Rockford 2009.
Really?
I do want to say that I also am excited. I was elated when I saw the Campaign Zero strategies and policy recommendations come out, because I often say that you know activism is great, but you have to have strategy, you have to have tactics, you have to be able to produce something tangible. It cannot just be about the protest. And these young individuals who have put these policy recommendations in place are, I believe, on the right track. I've downloaded what they have suggested specifically for state policy. I've looked at how that compares to Senate Bill 1304 and what we're already doing. And I can say that I'm committed to looking to see what I can introduce that's consistent so that the local efforts for Black Lives Matters will start to see even more support and even more backing for making sure that we reduce police abuse of power. I also think that we have to work, as has been stated before, to make sure that all individuals' constitutional rights are protected at all times. And then we have to make sure that our officers go home safely. So if we are doing all of those things, then we're doing what we should be doing as a community.
And Matthew, if you don't mind commenting, just your take on the policies that they're looking at through Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter.
No, I think it's awesome. I think that and the beauty is that there are people on the ground who are looking at the challenges and have decided that we want to use our voice and our power as individuals collectively to make a statement about making things better. And, you know, that's how communities change for the better. That's how people change systems that they see fault in. And I think that, as Dr. Wallace stated, locally, there have been a lot of efforts to ensure that our public safety officials, our, you know, policies and standards and procedures are not, you know, intentionally and overtly hurting people. And I think people in a city see those differences and see those changes, and it shows up in the community services officers, you know, on bikes, and it shows up in the events that take place between organizations like ours. So I think it's a great thing.
Okay. Thanks. Let's get to Diana for the if you can state your name and your city.
Diana Walker, Rockford, Illinois. My question is, we come to these events and we talk about violence and we look at it from the victims, but I think there's one component that we don't address, and I'd like to hear somebody address this, and that is, and I may be biased because I come from a law enforcement family, and that is what is done, and we're talking about what we do to stay, keep the community safe and put these practices in so the police don't do this to citizens. My question is, police deal with a myriad of issues every day and come into contact with mostly negative people. Mm-hmm. They don't come in contact, on the most part, with negative components. Mm-hmm. And how do they not internalize that? What systems are in place for our officers here in Rockford to help them in the healing process, and so that they're able to deal with people on a daily basis? I think we had great officers in Rockford. I can't honestly say that I know any bad apples. So I think there needs to be something in place that helps them also as an officer, as they protect and serve our community. And I'd like to know if there's something in place, and if so, what is it?
Well, I just want to briefly, and I'll allow the chief, because he would know if those services are available and what's going on, but I'm the daughter of an officer, and I think a lot of times, you're right, we focus a lot on the constitutional rights of the perpetrator or of the victims, but ultimately, officers want to go home to their families. They want to sleep at night safely, or whatever their shift is. They want to be able to go home and rest. They need that support. Hopefully, I'm pretty sure there are employee assistance programs for the stressors that come with the job. But I think what we just talked about in terms of humanizing the police officer, I hope that in these community outreach efforts, the officers become more human to individuals, and that they are less likely to be rude to those individuals who are serving us, protecting and serving us. I can speak, though, as a public servant. I think sometimes that people believe that because you are a public servant or you live a public life, they can speak to you however they want to speak to you, treat you however they want to treat you. And I can only imagine what that stress must be like day in and day out. My father was an officer for over 30 years, and he's probably one of the crankier, more crass people I know. But I know that it's because he's carrying the weight of 30 years of law enforcement experience, being a Vietnam War veteran. You know, those things weigh on an individual over time. But I do think that you are absolutely right. We have to look at what's happening with the officer and how they're coming home to their own family. And unfortunately, there's lots of domestic violence in the homes of our officers. But that speaks to some of the extraneous, stressful circumstances that happen. But we definitely, I hope, can humanize police officers through greater trust, greater relationship. And when people have better positive interactions with officers, I think they'll be less likely to be so rude as some people are. Not everybody is, but some people are.
I think your dad would be proud. That was nice.
Thank you.
Diana, You know, we obviously look at a lot of things. You know, we can refer officers to EAP. We have our chaplains program. We have in-service training. But really, the rubber meets the road with first-line supervision. I'm not close to the rank and file. I'm in my office or doing things during the day, but I'm not interacting with the field officers, if that's who we're talking about. But first, this is really important about the first-line supervisor, the sergeant that goes on calls, that sees that officer who comes to work every day, and the officer that he may know for 10 years, you know, he's not looking good today and he hasn't been looking good yesterday, and he's kind of curt with people, you know, pull him to the side, hey, what's going on? You need some help. And that's really important. And, you know, we've been talking internally and getting the oath back out, actually physically getting the oath of office back out that you signed. Take a look at that. What does that oath of office say, especially for a supervisor? Today's environment, policing is very difficult. Even to be a supervisor is even more difficult. Some people can be a supervisor and some can't. Some get into all the wrong reasons to be a supervisor. It's sort of a reality check on a daily basis to put the mirror up in front of you and say, is this a job for me as a law enforcement officer? It's the best career you ever can have, or it could be the worst day of your life. And some people can do it and some can't. And being a supervisor, it's very, very difficult. So we continually train. We help our supervisors to be able to help those officers get through the day, because it's difficult, the challenge and the things that we have to go through, especially if you have 25% of your violent crime is domestic violence. You don't know what's going to happen when you go inside that door, or you have shots fired, or the youth violence that's taking place.
There's I'd like to help give a response and cover two categories. One is when an officer is being investigated and has to have a case go in front of a grand jury. Just had an officer who was cleared based on a very tragic shooting that was very public. I had a conversation with Deputy Chief Dahlke, who's in charge of our use of force reporting and that entire process on the administrative side. He's also in charge of our training. So he gets to, on these incidents when there's a specific case being reviewed, he and I got in a conversation about what all of the management techniques and strategies are. And number one is ongoing communication during the course of that investigation. Sometimes, for whatever reason, these investigations go on longer than they probably should. That's huge stress on an officer when they're wondering, are they going to lose their career? Are they going to get theoretically charged with a homicide, you know, if they've taken someone's life? So that's all the best practice is talking about making sure you're engaged in that process and doing so on an ongoing basis. And then number two, when it's not an investigation, when it's just the daily grind of the job, been some very interesting research, and we've, it was publicized quite a bit that one of our former officers, retired officers, passed away and took his own life last year, and it was a huge tragedy. And some of the research that's been coming out about sort of chronic PTSD experiences and the suffering that a lot of times may be going on in silence and the lack of support. So what we're actually doing, we have a wellness center, many of you may know, that we've had up and running for just about a year now. What we're hoping to do is really build a tighter connection between our EAP program, Employee Assistance Program, which is an anonymous program. It could connect an employee to a referral network of support. But we want to make sure there's actually a physical place that they could walk into, which would be still maintain all of the confidentialities that they need, that could give them the support they need on an ongoing basis, and do whatever it takes to provide the kind of support both during the time of their service and into their retirement to make sure that we're supporting them. There's a lot of research now coming out of Iraq war veterans, other veterans from the military, and a lot of those same traumas and experiences over the course of a career could be impacting our first responder police officers.
I'd just say in terms of support, and it speaks to the comments about more diversity on the force. I was speaking to a black officer recently, just asking about, you know, what it's like and their experience. And he mentioned that he appreciates the camaraderie that exists on the force, but he said he's happy that there are more black officers and there's more diversity in the ranks, mm-hmm. because he feels more supported. And I think that, you know, just worth mentioning as we talk about how they're supported, that diversity helps.
I'm going to read one of the questions from the audience. Okay, well, let's jump to you first, and then I'll do one of these written questions.
Hello, I'm Anthony Hunt from Rockford, and my question is for you guys, really is about the cultural differences between, you know, a lot of the people who initially sign up to be police officers and, you know, the communities who have those issues. You know, what's done in you guys' training and in you guys' force to really connect those two worlds together, because, you know, they're the people who see each other, and kind of, you know, how these situations accelerate with, you know, the lack of understanding that one culture may have of the other, you know, just whatever it be. You know, what do you guys do about that kind of stuff?
So one of the things that we did with our not only our new officers but our new sergeants just recently, from cultural diversity, doesn't have to be black, brown, white, green, but just cultures in general, is take our staff over to the rescue mission when they're having dinner and integrate into the rescue mission and talk to some of the residents that come in or the people that are going to stop in. Take our officers over to Carpenter's Place, which is a daytime homeless shelter, and actually sort of say, this is what takes place. These are the things that you're going to be exposed to. Cultural differences, Lieutenant Givens is doing a great job with the Catholic Charities. A story just came out on Channel 13 about the individuals that are coming from Burma and what they've had to put up with genocide in Burma. They're escaping Burma to come to the United States of America. They specifically come to Rockford, Illinois. Now, the culture in Burma is much different there than it is in Rockford, and so Catholic Charities is integrating those individuals from Burma, and they don't have a great relationship with the police department. Actually, they're scared of the police in Burma. When they come here, they're like, okay, well, we're sort of the occupied enemy, and so we've had great discussions with those individuals. So those are just some examples that we do. It's really ongoing. We have internally, we use Dr. Thompson, and I know, Diana, you've had some training with him, civilians, our CAP volunteers, our police officer. Police officers, he's been with us for about 6 years, does training twice a year on cultural diversity. But that's got to be an ongoing conversation, you know, whether it be sitting at roll call talking about it or sitting at, you know, the city department head meeting. It can't just be once or twice a year. It's got to be going on every day.
And Senate Bill 1304 addresses cultural competency. So not just, I think diversity can sometimes be a gloss over term, but we need to make sure that there's a sense of inclusion. And competencies mean you are able to relate. And some of that is, you know, based on race, class, national origin. There's so many things that make up the individuals that are in our community that police have to interact with. And so the more the training is ongoing, as the chief just mentioned, the more officers are equipped to deal with and interact with individuals in a way that's consistent with that individual's culture. I think a lot of times it's, I'm going to impose how I think onto how you should think. You know, and we see that in general throughout our community, you know, you should name your event this or you should do that, rather than let me meet you where you're at. And cultural competency training helps to allow individuals to meet individuals where they're at.
I'll just add one small detail. I, again, had a recent conversation with one of our officers who was not born and raised in the area. This question comes up sometimes about, can an officer be an effective officer if they didn't grow up here, they don't live here? I think they can, but it takes work. And that's what his response was. He said when he joined the force, he had to make a concerted effort working with his field training officer, working with others to really get to know the community. That's something that, as the chief said, we could have policies and state laws, but ultimately it's our field work that happens to make sure. And by the way, the new law does require ongoing training at the field level to make sure that these things aren't just something you do at the police academy, which I think is outstanding and something we've been working on for the last several years. That's something, one thing that we're working with Rockford University and Rock Valley College on, and we'd love to be able to ultimately build, is a 2-year and 4-year degree partnership with our local. You shouldn't have to leave town to get an engineering degree. You also shouldn't have to leave town to get a degree to work for the Rockford Police Department or become a firefighter, et cetera. So we really want to tighten our connections and recruiting directly with all of our local high schools and the Explorers Post program so that we can ultimately do that. And we'd love to become a certified police training institute in Rockford. Right now, if you get hired, typically if you don't happen to have the training, when you get hired, you have to go down to, is it 12 weeks, 13 weeks of training? 12 weeks of training that I think I heard that might even be expanding.
It is. It's going to go from 12 to 16.
Yeah. So I would rather be doing that training here and getting that certification process here. So theoretically at a Rockford University, Rock Valley College, you could graduate with a four-year degree and your PTI certification at the same time and be working through internships with our department. Because then that way, if you're from Iowa, it doesn't matter where you're from. If you've worked with us while you're going to school here, we think that gives you a great leg up when you go to become a full-time police officer. And the cadet program also that the chief had was a chance for him when he was, how old, 18, chief?
18.
We'd love to bring a cadet-style program back. You probably wouldn't be carrying a gun, wouldn't likely be carrying a gun. You'd be doing other services to support the department, which we think would be a great way, another great way to get to know the community you're going to be working in.
Okay. Eric. And I do have some of your other questions here. I was going to kind of, near the end, fast-track them, but ask what you'd like.
My name is Eric Howenitz. I'm from Rockford, Illinois. And in the wake of Ferguson, less than a month after the riots in Ferguson, I was really flabbergasted as to why you deployed an armored vehicle on the streets of Rockford. I think that kind of represents almost a flagrant disregard for many of the concerns citizenry across the country had. And, you know, that's essentially part of the Black Lives Matter movement. Like, why would you deploy that less than 30 days after Ferguson?
What specific day and where was it deployed?
You put a press release out less than 28 days after the riots began in Ferguson about the armadillo, and I'm pretty sure people can pretty consistently see it on Auburn Street every day now.
Okay, now, so we're talking about two different things. You're talking about the vehicle that was on Auburn Street recently, and just want to clarify this, and you're talking about Ferguson. So I don't know of us putting out an armored vehicle after the Ferguson incident. That's why I'm asking you to tell me what the date was, because I don't believe we did. But if you're talking about the Auburn incident, it is a vehicle. It's called a nuisance abatement vehicle that's been used throughout the whole country. New York, the Wall Street Journal had an article about the various departments in the country. Unfortunately, Eric, there's a lot of businesses and residential areas that don't abide by the law, those people that live there. And so I get the police department gets complaints about either drug activity or gang shootings, et cetera. So what's been very effective is to take a nuisance abatement vehicle. Many times they take an old Brinks truck and then paint it into a police car and then set that vehicle out in front of that troubled house that the neighbors don't like. And we videotape those locations where we put that vehicle. And we have, you can go online onto our website. We're very transparent and open. We will put where that vehicle is located. Two locations that vehicle's been. Tremendous amount of shootings that have taken place over on Auburn Street. Young people have been shot, and buildings have been shot. That vehicle was placed there. And for the last 45 days, we've not had any shots fired. That was an effective tool. The other place where we've put that vehicle is down on Underwood Street, where we've had a tremendous amount of gunfire. When we show up, we have 40 and 50 rounds of ammunition that have been fired. We put that vehicle down there. Why? To deter criminal activity and to videotape. That is not an MRAP. That is an old vehicle that we had for our SWAT team that we equipped that looks like a police car. It's an effective tool, and the neighbors and the residents appreciate that vehicle being there because the gunfire is stopped.
If I can... I would just say everybody's entitled to their opinion, and please feel free to have whichever your opinion is. But when the riots were going on in Ferguson, the chief and I were talking continuously. We actually, I think the chief and I talked about, and you reached out to offer some support and guidance to some of their leadership there. I would be in total agreement if the question is, did they over-militarize the situation in Ferguson? I think so. My observation is. Absolutely. And I'll give you an example, much smaller, different case. But when we had the protests in Rockford as part of the fast food industry, I'm trying to remember the date of that. It was a year ago.
It was July.
No,
it was actually school was going on. It was in October.
That's right.
Of 2014. Auburn and Central.
2014, I
yes.
think it was.
Mm-hmm.
So when that was going on, we had, you know, we had some heads up that there may be an event going on. We practiced extreme patience in dealing with that because we knew we had certain people that weren't even from the community that were part of that protest that probably wanted to be able to videotape us arresting them and trying to make it more of a scene out of it. That kind of stuff happens. We have officers who are going to be taunted potentially and trying to provoked into activity. And I would just say our training is such that we there might be a tool or a piece of equipment that's appropriate in the right time, the right place, the right situation. It's about how you train and manage and monitor that. So I would agree that there should be concerns about the over-militarization, but the equipment itself is a tool. When it's used wrongly, it's used wrongly. And I think that's ultimately a function of the management, the supervision, the operations, not a fault in the tool by itself.
I think that your concern was that it was just after such a tense part or a tense event in our nation, and now we have a military-like vehicle in our community. So I think you were talking about the fact that that may be insensitive, if you will, and that it is kind of it's a psychological affront or assault too. And you know, I as I said, I'm not a law enforcement expert. I'm not a law enforcement expert, and I see exactly what you're stating, and what the mayor just stated about Ferguson. It was completely over militarized. As I was there, I mean, I got taunted. I saw the snipers. I had a police officer approach my friends and I in a very rude manner. I felt as if they wanted us to respond a certain way, but we did not. So I think those things happen on both sides. I do think that it's awful to see so much military equipment when it, you know, we're supposed to not be a war zone. And so you do not want to see something that reminds you of a war zone in your community. I understand that. And that was something that actually my father stated about the Ferguson situation. I asked him, what do you think should be happening right now, you know, as a law enforcement agent? His thought was they should take off the riot gear, put on their regular uniforms, and form a circle around the protesters who were there peacefully protesting and not antagonize those who came there to do negative acts intentionally. But I think that we have been in a situation in our city where, I don't know if luck is the word, but we certainly have been lucky, for lack of a better word, that some of those things have not happened here.
And I do want to ask you, Chief, what sort of military-style hardware do you have here or have access to with the county or nearby?
We have a couple vehicles. One, we've had the vehicle that was just mentioned that was a vehicle that we use for barricaded subjects, or we may respond, in the past, respond to a residence where there's a person who's armed. And we use that vehicle to go up to the residents, and then what we call throw the phone in, because many times they don't have a phone, or they the person inside has disconnected the phone. So we took that vehicle and re-equipped that to be a nuisance abatement vehicle. It was in the paper 2 or 3 years ago. We did receive an MRAP that replaced that vehicle. The MRAP has not been deployed in the city of Rockford, with the exception of one event that was on public display. Very sensitive to the MRAP. We even take a step back and look at all of our barricaded subject calls since I've been chief. We're very methodical. We don't call immediately, push the button, call the SWAT team, gas the house, and shoot it up. It doesn't take place in the city of Rockford, the police department. I'm very proud of the discipline of our SWAT team, our commanders, and it's very methodical in terms of if we have a barricaded subject. I'm in total communication with our city legal staff, with the mayor, with the aldermen of the area, with the police chaplains, and the first and foremost is the safety of our officers, the safety of the people that are in the home. And we've been able to de-escalate many of these situations without having to, and not on my watch, we've not gassed a house or have to shoot up the house. So I'm very proud of our of our barricaded subject calls or our people that have a gun in the house?
I would say I'd echo everything the chief said and give him even more credit than that. We're in constant communication when we've had some of these barricaded subject calls, and it's one of those areas where at times even there's another law enforcement agency that may be coming into our jurisdiction, and those become very sensitive situations. We've had some very tragic deaths to civilians involving chases that have occurred over the last few years. There's been some crashes even very recently. So one of the critiques that the chief received early on in his career as a chief stemmed from, and a lot of the protests, the 276-6 campaign had some at least a good foundation in challenges on the chief's discipline related to the chase policy and other discipline related to force that he was trying to manage. He's done an incredible job. He's received a lot of critique at times from those who think he has been too restrained. There's a balance. And right now, frankly, I think we need to do a better job at the policy level, the elected official level, and making sure that there's a unity and a respect across borders so we don't have someone in a high-speed chase from one jurisdiction that follows a different set of rules, comes into our community and kills one of our citizens or somebody that happens to be on our streets when potentially it could have been avoided. So we manage that. It's a very difficult thing. We are constantly reviewing it, but I think the chief has done a very commendable job. That's also something that we get reviewed by the National Accreditation Organization that we're part of. It's also something that there will be reporting requirements, I believe, within the new law related to those incidents when they result in a severe accident or death.
Okay, thanks. We only have about 10 minutes left, and I see we have a question over there. Oh, I thought Guy was indicating he had. There was another question. Oh, okay. How about right here? Here's one within your reach.
Most of it is effective immediately, and most of the provisions are already taking place in our area. So it's going to be police departments throughout the nation, namely Chicago Police Department. They're going to have lots of implementation growing pains, if you will.
So, but a number of the reporting provisions kick off in January of next year, or the first reports will be due either after the first quarter or second quarter next year. But a lot of it goes into effect immediately.
Okay.
I'm Wanda Hoover from Rockford, and this isn't a question. I think it's fairly safe to say that in Rockford and across the country, there's a lot of cynicism and criticism of police power. And so I would like to see our police department and the city have an ongoing PR program to constantly let the citizens know the good things that are going on. I read things in the paper, so I know they're happening, but I don't think we can have too much of it to counteract some of the prevailing attitudes here in Rockford.
And let's turn that comment into a question. What is being done PR-wise to get out the good message?
Yeah, you can go to our website, rockfordil.gov, police, and we put all of our good, bad, and indifferent information. We also tweet. The mayor tweets. I tweet. We put out press releases. So you have to look at multiple news sources. We also have a Facebook page.
So, well, every month we have I would challenge you. I haven't seen any department in Illinois doing this. There's only a few that I know of in the nation. Open public reviews of the department's work every month in our CompStat meetings. We do a summary when we look at all departments every month in our ROCStat meetings. We're now looking biannually at our use of force reporting. So twice a year we look at what our status is on our use of force incidents and the overall number of complaints against the department for excessive force. I'd challenge you to find another department in the state of Illinois doing that. I don't know of any. There's only a few that I know of in the nation that are doing it. We were commended in our last CALEA, the organization that reviews us for accreditation, on that work. We're not perfect, but we're committed to continuing doing this work open and transparently. And I'll tell you, I wish we had better PR. It seems like, but it's an ongoing challenge. We've hired recently a communications and public relations our marketing person for the city organization as a whole to help coordinate some of the work that happens on a daily basis throughout the departments.
I'd like to, sure. to say, it's not about the PR, like what is being done, but I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the fact that everything occurs within context. Nothing occurs within a vacuum. And so some of the cynicism and the things that we see are a result of historical precedents. And so it's going to take quite some time to overcome those things when there are communities within our city, within our state, within our nation that at one point were specifically terrorized by those who were to serve and protect. And we can't not recognize that. But I think what we can do is to continue to do the things that are happening now, the community relations piece, building and reestablishing relationships that are positive relationships so that at some point there'll be future generations that believe that that cynicism should never have existed in the first place. But right now, we have to be honest about what policing in America historically has meant to certain groups and use that as a basis to try to overcome the cynicism.
I told him not to let go of the microphone.
Okay.
So,
I will give it back. I'm Charlie Hare, and I don't live in Rockford, but my wife and I own a business here in town. And we do appreciate everything that the four of you are doing, and we do know it's in the best interest of the community. It seems like almost everything that everybody's doing is reactive, and there's not really a lot of programs that address what Matthew was talking about right at the beginning. A lot of the kids that are in and out, in and out, in and out, are not being shown. Manufacturing is a good example. There's a lot of manufacturing here in town that cannot find people to run the machines, and yet there's a lot of young kids. If they were given an opportunity, that may mean, people may not like this, being removed from their home and possibly put, not in a boot camp, but something similar to where they're being given more focused training, more focused attention, so that they're not going to be falling back to drugs or whatever, the violence that they're going through. Why aren't we looking at ways to do that, I guess? That would fall more to you, Latisa.
Okay. I would say that many of the business owners that I speak to echo the same thing, that there is a mismatch between their needs in the workforce and what applicants are presenting or who's able or willing to take the positions that are available. I do hesitate at the removal from the home. I think even with maladaptive behaviors, with proper intervention, homes can stay intact. And I think, unfortunately, our county is one of the largest, we have some of the largest number of DCFS cases in the state. And so I wouldn't advocate for anything of that nature. But what I would advocate for is continuing the work that Alignment Rockford is doing and expanding it. I think we've come kind of we've done a 180. So about 20, 30 years ago, vocational training was removed from the high schools in our area. That should just be standard. Not every person is going to go toward liberal arts and sciences. They should always have that option. And heaven forbid we ever get to a point where we're tracking students again, because that disproportionately impacted minority students. But I do think that we need to provide those vocational opportunities while we have them K through 12. I think that it's incumbent upon all of us to do greater public partnerships in such a way that as a business owner, perhaps you are willing to train one or two students in your company. I think it's going to take all of those things collectively, because obviously we don't have even a state budget at this point. So for me to be able to say we could help train individuals in a different way, or there are federal dollars for that, but I think we have to be more creative and more collaborative.
Well, when you look at the expense of somebody in and out, what's that cost that you can't really put a dollar on?
And I don't disagree. I mean, unfortunately, the state of Illinois spends far less than they should on per pupil education, about $7,000 a year. But you don't want to know what the cost over at the county jail is. You don't want to know what the cost is at IDOC. It's 5 to 6 times, 8 times the amount that we would spend on educating an individual.
I would just suggest to Sue that this is a great topic for the next forum, because yes. We could spend an entire evening, literally hours.
Seriously.
You don't have the right, I shouldn't say the right people. There's more people that should be at the table if we're going to have a good conversation about the failures of our education and employment systems. And I would just say that a lot of those conversations are happening, and I think it would be a very robust conversation. I'm a big believer. I was tracked. I was just tracked in a different way than maybe some others, but I was, you know, talked out of taking shop class. I wanted to take at Boylan because I was told that that was for the kids who aren't going to college. What, are you not going to college? You know, so I learned early on culturally, if you didn't want to be considered, if you want to be considered smart, you took a certain set of classes and not others. Now, if I need, I probably could use help changing light bulbs in my house because I never got any hands-on learning, right? So I think there's a deep dive being explored right now in all different types of learning. There's a lot of hands-on learning that we're finding out can also be supportive of theoretical learning. You do both. You don't have to do one or the other. You can do
both. Multiple intelligences.
Right. And yeah. So that's part of what's going on. The neat thing with the academies in the district, they're really setting the stage to be more supportive of both the hands-on learning experiences as well as the liberal arts and sciences.
I'll just speak to some work. So I wear a few different hats. And last year, a group of my friends and I, we founded a nonprofit organization called the Wobongo Leadership Council. And we exist to build leadership capacity in the African-American community. A lot of the work that we do is aimed at empowering people with information and skills so that we can come up, you know, so we're less dependent on systems and things like that. One thing we did this April, speaking of public-private type of partnership things, is the Park District flexes up really big in the summertime jobs and employment. And we looked at statistics around youth unemployment and found that 40% of young people in Rockford are unemployed. And when you look at black and brown youth, that's 60%, 60+%. So we wanted to be intentional about connecting young people to economic opportunities in the summer. We had this thing called the Youth Employment Series. It was over 2 days where we worked with volunteers, human resource professionals, other young people who had acquired education, came back to the city and are working in professional capacities. We had a group of about 40 young people working with Washington Park and Northwest Community Center, a couple other schools, and allowed the young people to participate in some workshops about professional presentation, communication. Two-thirds of the kids that came didn't have a resume before, they left with a resume. And everybody that came and participated in our event was guaranteed a job interview with the Park District. And we found that of the 40, there were 6 that were too young. It just, you know, came and participated. But only 5 of the young people didn't get employed. And so, you know, about being proactive, you know, we know that sometimes people respond to economic pressures. They feel like they need to, you know, have some money in their pocket. We want to do something to help young people get connected to jobs. So on a young, being proactive to help young people, United Way is working with leadership at Ellis Elementary School right now to develop what we call parenthood. Parent, H-O-O-D, is helping our own develop. And it's a parent support institute, kind of. They have a monthly parent night program, family night program. And of the 8 events that they hold throughout the school year, 4 of them are going to be connected in kind of an institute of programming aimed at creating peer-to-peer support for one another and ensuring that our organizations are really working to help people respond to the situation they find themselves in. So you have to help the family if you really want to help the kids, you know. And so there is a lot of work being done. Of course, we need to do more. And through collaboration, we're trying to make sure that people are empowered and can make decisions to change their lives.
All right. It's after 9 already. Thank you so much to our panel. And thanks to you for your great questions. And I had so many great questions I never got to, even some of my own. So, again, thank you so much for doing this. We're going to have a recording of this available soon, we hope, and we'll have that on our information about that on our website. Again, thank you so much for helping us out here tonight. This is WNIJ. I'm Susan Stevens.